The Word of Mouth podcast is brought to you by
Dartmouth Hitchcock. Imagine nationally ranked healthcare in your community.
With convenient locations throughout northern New England,
world-class providers are closer than you think. Visit dartmouthhitchcock.org to learn more.
Dartmouth Hitchcock is here.
Word of Mouth.
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 Mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. The 90s sitcom Friends ended 12 years ago, and it is still a hit.
Smelly cat, what are they feeding you? Everybody! Smelly cat, it's not your fault. Monica! They
won't take Netflix has put the entire series up for instant streaming, and people are passing around comments about the show online. Listicles, like 31 Friends jokes that never get old, are getting hits. So is a recent op-ed titled, How a TV Sitcom Triggered the Downfall of Western Civilization. The most confounding thing about Friends' resurgence is who's watching. Young millennials, many of whom never watched its original run in the 90s and early aughts. Adam Sternberg is an author and contributing editor for New York Magazine, where we found his recent article, Why Do So Many 20-somethings Want to Stream a 20-Year-Old Sitcom About a Bunch of 20-somethings Sitting Around in a Coffee Shop? And Adam, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you.
So numbers-wise, what is the evidence that there is a big trend among millennials watching Friends?
Well, this was an article that started really with the kind of anecdotal evidence that's often sort of ambient in nature. Our culture editor had been listening to a podcast where a TV critic, a prominent TV critic, Andy Greenwald, discussed going back to his high school to talk to students there and how he had been nervous because he thought, well, you know, he didn't even really know what kids like to watch on TV these days with all the crazy streaming options and new shows and everything. And when he asked the kids what they like to watch, they said, oh, we love this show called Friends, as if maybe he would never have heard of it. And once we started to dig into it, we realized that it is a kind of genuine phenomenon. First of all, a widespread phenomenon. You know, Friends is still in reruns across the country, and 16 million people watch it every week in its various airings on different stations, which, you know, it's not a one-to-one comparison, but 16 million people watching one show every week would be a viable network hit today. You know, networks would kill for a show that drew 16 million viewers. But also a lot of the new viewers who are discovering it are discovering it on outlets like Netflix, where they can stream it in its entirety, watch as many episodes as they want in a row. And, you know, in the course of researching this article, I met so many young people, early 20s and even teenagers, who are obsessed with the show. And they're only just discovering it now.
So are you a fan of Friends, or are you just scratching your head looking at this and thinking, why are they watching this?
I am both a fan of Friends and I am scratching my head looking at this, partly because I'm old enough to be sort of a Friends 1.0 fan. I remember when it was on TV every Thursday night and people would gather around and watch it. And I was always a little bit trepidatious about watching it at the time because it wasn't the coolest show in the world. It was very popular, but there were much cooler sitcoms to be into, like Seinfeld and shows like that. But over the course of its 10 seasons, you know, like many people, I kind of got sucked into it. And I certainly watched the grand finale of the show way back in 2004, along with about 50 million other people. And I, like those 50 million other people, I never imagined that the show would be culturally relevant 10 years later. It seemed really like a relic of a particular age, and especially because it's so much about being in your 20s and life in the 90s. So the scratching my head part definitely comes in once we realize that there's this whole new audience of people, especially since they're young people who you would think on the surface have very little in common with the 20-somethings as they're portrayed on the TV show, because Friends happened for the most part in an era before the internet, before social media, before all the sort of concerns that we associate with being young today. So the fact that young people were drawn to the show was a really intriguing phenomenon for me.
Yeah, you make that point in the article that this period, it was on from 94 to 2004, which is kind of, you know, the dawn of the internet taking over as the way that people communicated with each other. What does that have to do with this kind of nostalgic feeling about Friends?
Well, what I discovered in talking to people is that, in a sense, that distance that they feel from the characters in the show, there's many things that young people relate to, the standard things about relationships and starting out in life and being sort of nervous and excited about what's going to happen and having this kind of group of new friends that become really a sort of surrogate family for you. All of that is very appealing in the way that it always was for viewers. But for the younger viewers, it's also a chance to sort of live in a time that they don't live in when people really connected face to face, where the phenomenon of having a group of friends really centered on meeting in a coffee shop, hanging out in someone's apartment, not texting people, not meeting people through Tinder. You know, and to them, there's a real kind of nostalgic glow to that era. And they also have this idea that the 90s, in hindsight, was a very simple sort of halcyon age. Of course, those of us who remember it more clearly remember that it had all of the complications of any age. But to a young people, I think, given the kind of things they're dealing with now, given the complications, especially in terms of social interactions and things like that, the world of friends seems all the more appealing because it's devoid of all these kind of complicating factors.
Well, so when we were talking about this, this article was pitched at an ideas meeting. We were all surprised to hear that our youngest producer, Molly, had in fact just started watching Friends. So we thought we would get a firsthand look at why one 20-something is watching the show. Here she is. She's talking with our producer, Taylor Quimby.
Okay, Molly, why don't you introduce yourself?
I'm Molly Donahue. I'm a producer for Word of Mouth, and I'm a millennial.
How old are you specifically?
I'm 23.
When and why did you start watching Friends?
I started watching Friends a couple weeks ago, and I think I started watching it because it popped up on Netflix as, you know, something I would like, and it's popular now. You know, they have those bars where they tell you what's trending on Netflix.
Oh, like there's a banner that sort of said, like, why not watch Friends?
Yeah.
But there's so many TV shows out now. Why not something new? Why Friends?
It's new to me. You know, I've already watched How I Met Your Mother too many times. And here's a show that I've never seen, but is consistently popular. Everybody makes references to it all the time.
So you never saw Friends growing up?
I saw the odd episodes, but I didn't watch it, certainly. Like, people my age would watch it, and they... I remember distinctly them talking to our fifth grade teacher because she was also upset that it was ending. So, like, a bunch of 10 and 11-year-olds reminiscing with this 30-year-old woman about a TV show.
Do you think of Friends as being particularly dated?
No, because a lot of the stuff that I guess would seem dated doesn't feel important in a sitcom plot anyway. So, like, if you watch sitcoms that they make now, a lot of the time when they throw in technology stuff for a joke, sometimes it's just tropey and weird.
Yeah.
Or when they do use it, it's not something that couldn't be explained somehow else. I was just watching an episode last night where everybody's super worried because Ross didn't come home at night. Uh-huh. And, like, he does not do that. And they couldn't get a hold of him, which I guess if you're looking at it from a dated perspective is because they're in the 90s. There's no cell phones. But also could just as easily happen on a sitcom now because they'd be like, you didn't answer your phone.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Oh, man. You nailed it. All right. So are you going to keep watching?
Yeah.
And if it wasn't Friends, do you think there would be a different sort of older show that you might put in your rotation?
Yeah, definitely. I watch a lot of Frasier before I started watching Friends.
Oh, Frasier. Yeah, nobody's talking about the Frasier resurgence.
Among millennials. No. Maybe it's coming, though.
Molly Donahue, producer for Word of Mouth, with senior producer Taylor Quimby talking about Friends. She's a genuine millennial, and she is one of the many who is watching Friends right now. The sitcom did end more than 10 years ago, but it's got a whole new audience among millennials who've been streaming the show on Netflix. And Adam, what do you think? It's new to me, she says.
Yeah, I mean, that really points to the other factor here, which is a technological one. You know, in the 90s, when I was what would be a millennial now, in my 20s, a Gen X, you know, there was a real interest in old shows like The Brady Bunch, for example, and there was a kind of nostalgic love for shows like that that people had grown up on and were kind of re-watching. But at that point, there was really no way to rewatch the show unless you wanted to kind of sit up and wait for it to come on your TV set in syndication. Now, of course, the entire archive of culture is available at the press of a button, and you can basically stream an entire series from 20 years ago whenever you want. So I think if this phenomenon had occurred in a previous age, what would have happened is something like what we saw happen with the TV show Happy Days in the 70s, where people were kind of having a 50s nostalgia, so TV networks said, okay, let's make a 50s show for people. Now you don't need to make a 90s show for people because they can just watch the real thing from the 90s on Netflix and, you know, dive right in and see the whole thing from beginning to end. So in a sense, it's a sort of a cultural phenomenon, but it's also, I think, exacerbated by just the technological tools that we have now.
I lived in New York in the 90s when Friends was extremely popular and, you know, there are many women wearing the Rachel haircut and many people using Friends as a reference. But nobody's apartment looked quite like that. You know, that was the whole thing. It was a fantasy then and it's a fantasy now. I think that's one of the points you make in your article.
Yeah, it's interesting talking to young people now watching the show and the extent to which they believe that that was what life was like in the 90s. I think they understand there was always a kind of wish fulfillment element to the show. And certainly the New York that was depicted back then was not a New York that existed then. And it's not one that exists now. That West Village apartment that the women lived in would be even more unattainable now than ever before. But the kind of genius of the show is it presents this sort of fantasy version of that moment in life when you're just surrounded by these new friends and everything is possible and sort of scary and you're falling in love with each other and you don't know who's going to get together. And, you know, it's not a show that ever really dealt with big issues or serious political issues or anything like that. I think it very smartly kept to us almost a sort of soap opera conceit where it was all about who's falling in and out of love with who. And that, I think, is why, you know, the appeal of it has persisted.
So all of these digital natives raised with technology all around them, nostalgic for a pre-ultra-connected time. How about for you? Do you feel any nostalgia for the Friends era?
Oh, I certainly do. I certainly feel nostalgic for an era which I can actually remember being an adult in before sort of 24/7 online connectivity when the experiences you had throughout the day were really just the things you did in the physical world and the people you met and the people you talked to. You know, nowadays, like many people, I have full work days that spent mostly just on the computer answering emails or talking to people or looking at websites. And I certainly think about what the difference between what life was like before and what it is now. But I always kind of chalk that up to just getting old and being nostalgic in a sort of typical way. So that's why I was very interested to find that there is a strain of that nostalgia among people who don't remember what it was like before you were online all the time and you had a little computer in your pocket, that to them there's an appeal to that era as well.
Right. We don't have that, but we have Friends. Well, Adam, thank you for speaking with us.
Oh, thank you so much.
Adam Sternberg, he's an author and contributing editor for New York Magazine, and you'll find a link to his article on the resurgence of Friends at wordofmouthradio.org. I'll be there for you. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Before the break, we talked about the sitcom Friends, and later in the show, I'm going to talk with the conductor Jonathan McPhee, who's whittling down the Das Rheingold and Die Walküre operas from Wagner's Ring Cycle into more manageable portions. So we're mashing up the low and highbrow on the show today, and this next piece falls perfectly in between. Tom Dodson reports on a very unusual life drawing class.
If you're like me, you stop drawing sometime around fourth or fifth grade. I would bet that you have, in your head, more or less the same picture that I do of a life drawing class. There's a studio, and at the front of the room is a nude reclining model. She's silent and dignified, maybe a little bored. Then there are the art students, sketching the outline of her form. They are solemn and workmanlike behind their easels, their minds purified of any hint of lust or juvenile titillation. Their heads float in the chaste clouds of platonic forms. Dr. Sketchy, a regular life drawing session held in a rotating set of Boston bars and nightclubs, is, well, nothing like that.
Hi, I'm Aliza Shapiro from Two Serum Productions. Dr. Sketchy is a life drawing session where all of the models are usually burlesque performers or drag queens or performance artists from the community. And Dr. Sketchy was started in New York by Molly Crabapple, who's an amazing illustrator and creative thinker. And she came up with the idea and then she franchised it around the world.
Tonight's models are a group of performers that call themselves the Bunny Collaborative. Helena Prezio serves as the troupe's artistic director, but prefers her official title, Bunny Wrangler.
The Bunny Collaborative is a collection of circus freaks, no, is a collection of performance artists, burlesque dancers, aerialists, actors, directors, insane asylum residents who perform in conjunction with Walter Sickert and the Army of Broken Toys, the best steampunk band on the planet.
And what is, how would you classify the genre of steampunk?
Walter, come here.
A burly, bearded man in a trench coat lifts his head and crosses the room. This, it turns out, is Walter Sickert, front man for the Broken Toys.
Can you describe what the music is, like what kind of genre it is?
That's why you had
yes.
Unanswerable question. It's kind of like
steam crunk.
We call it steam crunk, and it's not steampunk. It's steam crunk, right? But to describe that sound is kind of like when you're a kid, and like you fall asleep watching Punky Brewster, and your Teddy Ruxpin's like talking to you backwards, and then you're like, boy, I want to run away and join a circus. That's what the band's like. With ukuleles, violas, clarinets, guitars and pianos and singing, oh my.
A few minutes later, the performers take the stage and the artists take out their sketchbooks or fire up their tablet devices. Other sketchers put in last-minute orders for drinks. One artist explains what keeps him coming to Dr. Sketchy.
Yeah, my name's Phil Eckberg. I'm an art teacher.
And so what do you enjoy about coming here as opposed to a more traditional life drawing class?
A little more fun, less dodgy. Also just the dynamic of having a variety of different, not necessarily subcultures, but just different kinds of poses, different kinds of people. The humor seems a lot better. It just seems to flow easier. It's just a lot more fun. The idea of being able to have people in different costumes, that's really helpful as well, because figure drawing is figure drawing a lot of times, but being able to have people that are coming at it from different costumes or different hairstyles or things like that, it really adds some variety, and that helps you strengthen yourself as an artist.
There's certainly no shortage of costumes and unusual poses. The first trio of models features a glamorous and nearly nude Marilyn Monroe type, her blonde hair elaborately coiffed. She's accompanied by a buxom and brightly smiling woman in a corset and veiled hat. A third model, in a leopard print brassiere, drapes herself upside down across the frame of a folding chair, her arms out and her shapely legs pointed upwards. The artists look worried. It's a 20-minute session. She'll be fine, she says. She's an acrobat and is used to holding this pose while dangling above her audience. Sometimes, though, the costumes can cause problems, like when burlesque performer Porcelain Dahlia's pasty starts to slip.
Hey, Justin.
Yeah?
Want to help me fix my pasty?
Oh, my gosh.
It's awesome.
You made me look.
It's migrating.
Justin, this is your job. It's your lot in life.
Pasty Wrangler.
Pasty Wrangler!
The poet and performer Jojo Lazar used to take art classes at Brandeis, but found that her instructors didn't always appreciate her approach to drawing.
I remember my art teachers really didn't know what to do with me. They called the way I drew noodling. And I got called on noodling, and I'm doing air quotes, you can't see that, but when I was doing the details like pubic hair on the models or freckles, and I was like, then what the crap do you want me doing? But capturing the adorable intricacies of people's genitals.
At Dr. Sketchy, though, Lazar says she's found an open, fun place to celebrate both creativity and nudity.
And I think it's really a celebration of all shapes, all sizes, all skill levels. I consider it, rather than a critical environment, utterly welcoming. And, like, it's so funny that nudity is still shocking in our society. It's like, hey, the 60s happened, didn't they? But I think Dr. Sketchy's confronts that, like, with a sense of trying to promote it as normalcy and as celebratory. So I'm into that. Celebratory nudity!
And, as another artist observes, the models don't just quietly hold their poses. They engage with their illustrators, telling jokes and sharing stories.
Well, I like all the costumes that everybody brings, and usually the jokes are pretty raunchy and funny. It's a relaxed attitude, so that's mostly why I come. I really like the performers that Elisa brings in, too.
I have another joke.
Run it.
All right. I went to a seafood disco last week, and I pulled a muscle.
Ah. No.
draw.
The last group of models descend from the stage to socialize with the artists. They take a look at the knight's drawings and graciously accept tips, tucking them into bras and under garter straps. Then it's time to put away the folding chairs and change the space from an art studio back into a dance floor. No one seems to mind, though. It's not even midnight yet, and with this crowd, loud, friendly, and well lubricated, you get the feeling an impromptu dance party might break out at any minute.
And that story was produced by Tom Dodson.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of mouth.
Word of
mouth.
This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott. Enormous, heroic, epic, clocking in at nearly 20 hours, Wagner's Ring Cycle is an ambitious undertaking, typically staged only by the world's largest opera companies and houses, and seen only by those willing to travel and sit for the equivalent of 2+ work days. Well, diehard and would-be Wagner fans living locally will have a chance to catch this spectacle live, or at least the essential parts. Symphony New Hampshire is performing part one of The Essential Ring this Sunday at the Keefe Center for the Arts in Nashua. Jonathan McVie is music director for the symphony and the Lexington Symphony and the Boston Ballet, but still has time to join us now. Jonathan, welcome to Word of Mouth.
Thank you, Virginia.
So The Essential Ring, how did you winnow it down to what is essential?
Well, you laid out very well the fact that it is a mammoth undertaking as an audience member as well as a performer. And people actually know more of the ring than they think they do, and it has permeated our society in a wide variety of different ways, going all the way back to my first exposure, which was Elmer Fudd and Bugs Bunny.
Of course, all of us.
Kill the Wabbit. But what I really wanted to do was to try and take away a little bit of that wall of, oh my goodness, do I really have 2.5 work days that I can sit there and take this all in, or be able to do sort of a Reader's Digest focus on the greatest sections of this. So I actually spoke to friends who were Wagner fanatics and said, can you make a list of everything in these four operas that you absolutely could not live without? And I ended up with about 14 different people weighing in on it. And I simply went through and gave each section a vote. And then I looked at the ones that had the most votes, and it was like, okay, if there's any way I can keep these sections in, I definitely will. What I wanted to do was create basically a new opera that combines the first two, and then part two is the second two operas.
Okay, so let's just clarify. There are four parts to the Ring Cycle.
Correct. Four operas.
Okay, and so for those unfamiliar with the opera, we do have a great description. This is Jad Abumrad, known to public radio listeners from Radiolab. He produced a one-hour special about it. This is how he described the Ring Cycle.
If I had to describe it in one sentence, it would go something like this. The Ring is a German romantic view of Norse and Teutonic myth influenced by a Greek tragedy and a Buddhist sense of destiny, told with a socio-political deconstruction of contemporary society, a psychological study of motivation and action, and a blueprint for a new approach to music and theater.
Okay, how do you do?
That's brilliant. No, I know that Radiolab show, and it is absolutely wonderful.
Well, give us a little primer on what goes on in this opera.
Oh, boy, can I describe it? The story is incredibly complicated. He really hit the essence, which is it starts in the beginning with this magic gold being protected by the three Rhine maidens at the bottom of the Rhine River. 20 hours later, it ends up in exactly the same place, having gone through human foibles, heroics, gods going through exactly the same kind of heroics and foibles. Everything comes crashing down that has been built up over this entire legend, only to end up with the magic gold right back where it started from, safely back in the water.
Well, Wagner was known as a bit of a control freak, even beyond the music and the libretto, which he wrote, to the staging, to the audience, you know, how they were going to experience this opera. I'm curious, what do we know about this part of his character that you chose to mess with a little by shortening his opera?
Yeah, he probably would be completely incensed by that. But what I was trying to do was be true to his sense of drama. In other words, when you come to part one, you will feel like you're hearing one complete work. It's not a collection of excerpts or snippets. And I have more appreciation for how brilliant he was in putting this piece together now than I did, you know, even years ago when I actually sat through a whole Ring cycle as a music student in London when they did them back to back for a weekend.
So what was revealed to you?
That his true genius was really creating a completely different form of opera and musical composition. Prior to Wagner on the opera scene, you had a collection of arias, which is a song, that for the most part did not move the story forward. And then you'd have what's called a recitativo, which is a little connector section to get to the next song. Wagner, we always use the word aria in quotes because there aren't really those song connector bits. The vocal arias in a Wagnerian opera are actually plot as well as beautiful pieces of music, and it's what we call through composed. So you start at the beginning and it goes in a development line right straight through to the end of that particular opera without really a break. And the other thing that he did that's incredibly special is he elevated the role of the orchestra. So instead of the orchestra being merely an accompaniment, maybe doing the odd orchestral interlude while they're changing scenery to get to the next bit, the orchestra is as important as the vocal parts, and I wanted to leave those in. So you started with Ride of the Valkyries. Mm-hmm. That's completely in there with the 115 people playing that he would have specified. I did cut a couple of corners because, for example, when they're forging the magic ring, which gives the owner of the ring the ability to control the universe, that's forged by 19 people hitting anvils. And I didn't have 19 people hitting anvils, well, or even 19 anvils.
How did you get all of these people? I mean, when I see Wagner's Ideal Symphony, I just think huge. What
it
did you
huge.
Do in New Hampshire?
Well, that's why I put both orchestras together. So actually, the fact that I am close enough and have two regional symphony orchestras of excellent quality that are close enough so that we can put them together in each city, Lexington and Nashua, gives me that double orchestra size. And then, of course, being able to bring in amazing Wagner vocal talent that we have for this, too, is really incredibly special.
Well, let's hear about that. The singers include the soprano Jane Eaglin and the Metropolitan Opera headliner Thomas Studebaker. Just mm-hmm. very, very big names in the world of opera. Tell us a little bit about what they bring to this production.
Well, a Wagnerian singer is a very special kind of singer. First of all, they have to have an incredible amount of power to be able to cut through an orchestra that big. And there are a lot of wonderful singers in the world who may excel singing Verdi or Mozart operas who would never even think of touching a Wagnerian opera just because the demands of it makes on the voice are so incredibly huge that you could actually completely blow out your voice if you don't have the kind of stamina, endurance, and that particular kind of vocal power. These people that we have in the cast, Jane, Thomas, Margaret Jane Ray, who's singing, Alfred Walker, who's Votan, those are people who really specialize in this kind of repertory.
Wagner's Ring Cycle is perhaps the epitome of the grand, epic, enormous opera, clocking in at nearly 20 hours. It's an opera in four parts. Well, Symphony New Hampshire is going to be performing part one of what it's calling the Essential Ring, a sort of pared-down version, this Sunday at the Keefe Center for the Arts in Nashua. We're speaking with Jonathan McPhee. He's music director for the New Hampshire Symphony and the Lexington Symphony, who will be performing together. Well, let's hear just a little bit. This is Jane Eaglin. She's performing the part of Brunhilde, and here's a clip from her battle cry. Right, geez.
I mean, can you listen to that without just wanting to jump out of your seat?
I know. It's so powerful. And also, you know, this role, Brunhilde, is almost the, you know, the quintessential stereotypical operatic, wearing the Viking horns and the blonde braids. It is such an amazing scene. It must be a real challenge to sing, obviously.
Oh, yeah. I can't wait, actually. Tonight, I'm meeting the singers to do our first piano rehearsal with them, and looking forward to it. They've all flown in. I think most of them came in last night.
And every character has his own theme, so to speak. This is something that Wagner did for this. Was this groundbreaking? Had that ever been done before?
Yeah. Well, you know, it's funny. Before Wagner, you would see the odd composer using a melody to associate it with a character. But Wagner really took it to the ultimate degree, where every single person, place, or feeling has its own melody. So there's over 150 melodies for the whole thing. Now, what does that mean? That means that even if you removed the vocal line that has the words that tell you what's going on, when you hear a theme like Wotan Spira's theme, boom, 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 every time you hear that, you know Wotan's coming on stage. But if you hear that theme and it's mixed in with another character's theme, there's obviously some exchange that's going on between them. And that concept of telling basically the dramatic story in how these themes interact with each other, who's on stage at the same time, or even sometimes having the theme morph into a new form, actually tells the story all by itself. And that's something that in today's world, movie music such as Star Wars, where
I'm thinking
that Leia's theme.
Right. You know when Darth Vader's coming because you
hear
the Darth Vader theme.
And, you know, you've got the spot where Han Solo gets thrown into the carbonite chamber, and what do you get? The Imperial March, which means Darth Vader comes on the scene, and there you can see it. And then you have that moment where Han Solo says to Leia, no, 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 it's okay, don't fight it. And he gets thrown in, and what do you hear? You hear the love theme. So, you know, John Williams absorbed this whole way of writing, as did Howard Shore in Lord of the Rings, the Tolkien trilogy.
Apocalypse Now again brought back this music for us. Colonel Kilgore, you know, playing Flight of the Valkyries. And this is something interesting because this is where life imitates art. This apparently soldiers in Afghanistan and Iraq also would play this inside of their vehicles, you know, as they're about to mount an attack to get things stirred up. And So what is it about this, Jonathan McPhee? Why does it still captivate so? Why do people travel around the world to see the Ring Cycle like, you know, deadheads?
You know, people forget that music is not only a universal language, but it's something that's really basic to human beings. And I think Wagner, with the germs that he put into this piece, managed to hit that right spot, both, you know, warrior themes and love themes, but he really touched on the human soul. And when you think about it, if you go all the way back to any civilization in the world that the world has ever known, you will find that every time there is a major human event, whether it's going to war, birth, weddings, someone passes away. You've always got music there. And the music is something that is our way of emotionally plugging into something. And that means it can also be misused. It can also become a propaganda tool for the same reason. I mean, anytime you've got any kind of conflict, there's always a fight song that goes along with it. So it is something that's basic to us as human beings. You can't separate it.
Well, Jonathan McPhee, I wish you the absolute best. It sounds like a fantastic production.
It's going to be a lot of fun, and I really hope people in New Hampshire will come, because this is not something that you get a chance to do and hear every day.
Conductor Jonathan McPhee, he's music director for Symphony New Hampshire and the Lexington Symphony. They are both joining forces with the Boston Wagner Society to present part one of The Essential Ring, and that is this Sunday at the Keefe Center for the Arts in Nashua. There are more details on tickets and the event at wordofmouthradio.org. This is Word of Mouth from NHPR. I'm Virginia Prescott, and it's time for the latest installment of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop. Diane Lebec cut her teeth as a young adult writer, but her most recent novel, called Breaking Wild, is mysterious and thrilling and ventures deep into adult territory, landing in the rugged backcountry of Colorado, where an experienced elk hunter and outdoors woman has gone missing. Lebec also lived out west for a time, but is now in New Hampshire and on the faculty of Southern New Hampshire University's MFA program. We steered her into a storage closet before her reading at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, where I asked her what she finds toughest to write, the first sentence or the last.
For me, hands down, the first sentence. No question about it. It was so daunting for me. And I tend to live with a novel for a long time before I can force myself to get started writing it. I love to swim, and I think writing that first sentence is a lot like standing at the edge of a cold lake. And I'm one who just stands there and stares at it and stares at it and stares at it. But I'm also one who doesn't ease myself into it, or I will never get into the water. You know, if I know how cold it is, I use the Nike mantra, just do it. I have to sit there and go, just do it, woman. Come on, get in there. Just do this. And so it's literally jumping in there.
Are there personal habits that you would encourage other writers, maybe even aspiring writers, to pick up to become more productive?
I really like the idea of challenging myself toward a certain word count every day. Everybody has a different formula that works for him or her, but that works for me. So typically toward the beginning of the novel, maybe I set 500, 600, 700 words. As I start moving past that point, it becomes 1,000 words. Then it becomes 1,500. Mid-novel, it's always 2,000. And then I'm just really gearing up, 2,000 to 2,500 till the novel's done. For me, what I learned, and I think I learned it a little too late, is find that balance in your life. There's the former ambassador to Saudi Arabia. I heard him say this once, and I will never forget it. Know what brings you peace and protect it at all costs. And that struck with me so profoundly. And what I realize is there's so much noise going on. If we can know what brings us peace and we can write from a place of peace, it's amazing to me how much easier the writing process is when we're at a place of peace.
So for you, what disturbs your peace? What's your worst distraction from getting work done?
The noise in the world. No, I think part of me wants to say, because I'm a woman, but I don't think that's fair to men, but responsibilities. Right. And so I've raised three sons of my own. I now have two stepchildren. There's bills to pay. There's responsibilities. And I am a perfectionist, and I feel very responsible to my family, to my children, to my dog, to the house. I want to get everything done. And there's just so much noise out there screaming at us, you should be doing this, you should be doing that. So where do we find that courage to stand up and say no, even if we get judged for it? I'm going to protect myself. Maybe I'm going to make less money. Maybe I'm going to live differently. Maybe I'm not going to go to that party I should go to, or, have the latest clothes I should have, or whatever it is. But really, really say no to the noise.
So what's the best environment for you to write in?
Best environment for me is an 8x8 shed that I put up outside my house next to the woods. and it has plywood interior. It has a plywood desk. There's no memorabilia, no family portraits. The only thing in there, aside from my writing materials, is a little plastic horse that my husband got me on our honeymoon, and I call him Owen, and he's my muse. Aside from that, it's just stripped down to the writing and the story.
It sounds like a kind of cold isolation tank.
You know, but it's not, because I look out at these beautiful views from the window, and I have a propane heater in there, and I have a candle. I do have a candle. So it's quite cozy in my story world.
So before you start a book, how much research do you do? How much of the work do you make sure you get done before you even write that first word?
I write realistic fiction. So for me, the research is incredibly important. I spend a great deal of time trying to walk the steps of my characters, trying to inhabit them, and understanding what my story is before I get started. I know that's very different than a lot of writers, but I need the basic bones of what I'm writing, and I need to feel it, I need to sense it, smell it, touch it. And that's why I say I might spend a year with my story researching it very intimately before I begin the writing process.
So for new writers, what do you think you'd recommend for them as tools maybe to learn about writing?
And one thing Toni Morrison said, and I'm going to paraphrase her, but basically write the book that you want to read. And that really, really still sings to me. I think they need to read what they love, and they need to write what they love. Yes, I think we need to challenge ourselves and read all kinds of different works. But when it comes to our creative process, you should be writing a book that you would just be dying to pick up and read. And then don't get discouraged. Don't focus on the publishing process. And that's easier said than done. You know, you see a book, a dust jacket, you want your book to be that one day, and you have to focus on the writing. You just have to.
Were you rejected before getting published?
Sure, at different points. But I feel like probably not as much as most, because I'll share another piece of advice that was given to me by a literary legend, Carol Hawke Smith, who is a really dear friend of mine. She was editor-at-large at W.W. Norton before she passed away. And she said, you only get an agent or editor's eyes once. And I took that to heart. So don't show your work to an editor or an agent until you're ready. Really be focused on the process of that writing. Again, don't be focused on the publishing. And the rejections may come, but I think you will hopefully have fewer of those if you don't let go of the work till you're ready. The other thing she also told me was to really read good work. You know, challenge yourself with language. So on one hand, I say read what you love, but also challenge yourself, read the greats. You know, another habit I have is I start my morning reading short stories before I start writing. So that's always a must, and they're great short stories. You know, they're really well done. So I think that's another important piece of advice that she passed down to me as well. She used to clear her shelves and send me the books, and that was wonderful. You know, writers that she'd worked with, Joan Silber's one of them, and her short stories, which was just terrific. And I think the last point of advice I would like to pass on that's really resonated with me was something Andre Dubuis said, and that is, imagine, don't create. And I've used that with so many of my students, because once you understand what that really means and you feel that, you know what he's talking about, it makes all the difference, because then your stories become real. They're not manipulated, they're not contrived, they're not flat. They're living, breathing stories that inhabit your readers and I think can become living, breathing memories.
Diane Lebeck, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you so much.
Diane Lebeck there, author most recently of Breaking Wild. She gamely spoke to us in the storage closet at Gibson's Bookstore in Concord. You can hear more episodes of the 10-Minute Writer's Workshop by subscribing to our podcast. There's a link on our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or look up 10-Minute Writer's Workshop on iTunes. Thank you for listening to Word of Mouth. There is much more to hear and explore at our website, wordofmouthradio.org, or with our podcast, which you can listen to anytime you wish. You'll find it by searching Word of Mouth NHPR in iTunes. I'm Virginia Prescott. We'll see you next time here on NHPR.